Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. We'll take a look today on the show at how funeral homes in the state have been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Funeral directors, we all want to try to take care of somebody the best way possible, and we're not able to do that because of what's going on.
U.S. Senator Mike Enzi is finishing up his time in Washington.
I'm ready to be in Wyoming and excited about it.
And the Festival of Lights, better known as Hanukkah, is upon us. We speak to a religious studies professor about the holiday's special meaning this year.
We are fortunate that we hadn't been touched by the virus as much as some people across the country.
And people prepare to spend Christmas alone. It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. On this last show of 2020, we begin where we spent a lot of our time this year, talking about impacts from the pandemic. We've seen a lot of numbers of cases and deaths all related to the COVID-19 pandemic. With those rising number of deaths due to COVID-19, funeral homes have been very busy. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rouse says it's required some changes in how they operate.
In the last 6 to 8 weeks, the number of COVID deaths has increased quite a bit in relation to what we experienced originally on the onset of the initial lockdown and the early pandemic response.
That's Jeff Jacoby, one of the owners of Schrader Funeral Homes. It's located in three locations, Cheyenne, Casper, and Rollins. I wasn't really familiar with the concept of funeral homes. This story gave me the opportunity to delve into the process and systems that funeral homes have in place. However, a lot of things have changed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Jacoby says that during the beginning of the pandemic, he saw a small increase in the number of services requested related to COVID-19. But that's changed in the past month, as cases and fatalities related to COVID have grown. So his business has had to implement a lot of changes in the way they deal with services and customers.
As we've gone forward, we've learned to deal with COVID-19 in regards to arranging services. One of the ways we've done that is through live streaming our funeral and memorial services. And that's been very, very helpful because it's given families an opportunity to gather, sometimes remotely, but still gather together as a family while still including friends and loved ones who are far away that want to be part of celebrating that person's life. So live streaming, that technology has played an important role for us as a funeral home.
For traditional services that involve viewings and visitations, they've limited the seating capacity. Depending on the number of people, attendees would have to sit in every other row who are not family members. For the staff and employees working at Jacoby's funeral homes, procedures for cleaning were issued immediately. Staff had to stay informed and updated at all times on the latest developments of COVID-19 and make sure that everyone always has their PPEs.
We cut our staff in half and we divided our staff to where we created a schedule at our two larger locations, one in Casper near Cheyenne, where we divided our teams. So we were exposing our staff half the time. We're making sure that people that enter the funeral home are wearing their mask. Our staff members wear their mask, trying to make sure that our staff remains healthy. We provide them all the necessary tools and protection that we possibly can.
These new changes and implementations also apply to Valley Mortuary, a funeral home in Jackson. Tyson Clemens is the funeral director there.
With COVID-19, almost everything has changed. Everybody's wearing a mask. It makes it hard to understand. Just like in everyday living, we are having to go through the same trials as everybody else.
They're also utilizing technology for services, limiting the number of attendees during a service, and taking the important necessary procedures for staff and employees to stay safe. There's another thing Clemens noticed.
The number of cremations has increased just because it's easier for families to put a service off. And when I say that, it's easier that we can go ahead and do the cremation now And then in the summer, when things hopefully slow down as far as COVID transmission, they can get together in the summer and have services then.
Clemens says it's been difficult not to interact with families who are mourning.
Funeral directors, we all want to help. We all want to try to take care of somebody the best way possible. And we're not able to do that because of what's going on.
Back in Cheyenne, Jeff Jacoby, who is one of the owners of Schrader Funeral Homes, says it's been a trying year for everyone, but is hopeful for the future.
Because I know for a fact that this will end in time. Some sense of normalcy, whatever that might be, is something that we all look forward to.
For Tyson Clemens, he thinks it might still get worse before it gets better, but it will get better. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Nina Rao.
Now, from deaths to a cure. This week, Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen hosted a Facebook Live event with Dr. Rupali LeMay of Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health to discuss the COVID-19 vaccine. We've put together some highlights for you from that event, starting with what it means that a recent survey found that most, but not all, Wyomingites say they would be willing to get vaccinated against a virus.
Vaccines are really amazing, I think, medical sort of innovations that we have had, but vaccines don't save lives, but vaccinations save lives. And what we have found in this pandemic, there has been some modeling that has shown about 70% of the population needs to gain immunity, meaning you can really get an immunity in two ways. You can either be exposed to the virus and then have antibodies because your body has been exposed to it, or you can get the vaccine. So it's a combination of these two things that we need to be really looking at to get to herd immunity. And if we can get to herd immunity, that means essentially the virus will die out, because the whole reason a virus lives is to replicate, right? It wants to just find another host, a susceptible host, and then continue to replicate onward. And so what the vaccine helps us do is it helps us reach that herd immunity much more quickly. We need to have a sizable proportion of the population accept the vaccine and get the vaccine for us to be able to reach herd immunity.
And, you know, this idea of herd immunity, it really reminds me of what's been said. Even Dr. Anthony Fauci has really pointed this out, that, you know, even after someone is vaccinated, it's still really important to wear a mask, to take all these social distancing precautions that a lot of us have been taking since March. Can you explain why that might be?
Even if you get a vaccine, which, you know, a lot of healthcare workers are starting to get the vaccine now, even if you get a vaccine, it's still important to continue to wear a mask. It's, you know, if you can social distance, continue to stay at home as much as possible until we reach that herd immunity, right? Because the issue is gonna be, until we get enough people to that threshold and to that level, it's still important for us to continue these other public health recommendations, which, as you mentioned, a lot of people have been doing since March. We know people are tired, but I think if people can wait just a few more months, we will start to be able to start to see some semblance, I would say, of getting back to normal.
Looks like we got one of our first questions. Why are they suggesting you get the vaccine when you have already had COVID? It's a good question.
It's a great question. And I think part of it has to do with antibodies and how long your immune system remembers something. And so for some people, if they've gotten COVID, they still have antibodies in their system for several months. For other people, they don't have antibodies for several months. So what the vaccine does is it makes sure that even if you've had COVID in the past, that it introduces that pathogen into your body so that your body is therefore ready if it encounters it again, to be able to fight it. So that's really the reason why.
You know, of course, vaccine hesitancy is not new. It's something we've seen well before COVID-19. In fact, I think I saw somewhere there was a poll that was taken regarding the polio vaccine. Way back then, folks were hesitant to take that vaccine. But I'm wondering, it seems like there are more factors at play with this one. I mean, what's your sense of that?
So I would say pre-COVID, I think the reasons why people might be hesitant about vaccines could sort of fall into four domains or four categories. So people were concerned about ingredients in vaccines. People were concerned about the vaccine schedule. So this is in relation to childhood vaccines. So how many shots a child gets at 2 months, 4 months, et cetera. People had typically lower levels of risk perception, meaning they didn't think that they were susceptible to the disease that the vaccine was preventing, or they thought that if they got the disease, it wasn't severe. And then the last piece is sort of the major safety issue. People were afraid of side effects from vaccines. I think since then, it has evolved over time with regards to what's happening with COVID. And I think there is a perception that people think that the process has been maybe politicized a bit because of what has happened over the last 9 months. So there's that piece. The other piece is also this whole issue of, as you mentioned, that people are concerned that perhaps the process cut corners because it was expedited. And then the third is really this idea is that it's a new vaccine. It's also a novel pathogen. So you're dealing with not only a new vaccine, which tends to sometimes lead to more people hesitating about it, but it's also a pathogen that we don't know as much about. And so I think together, you know, thinking about all of this together and then this information on social media that has had a lot of misinformation and just a lot of challenges that Americans have had, I think, with regards to adhering to public health recommendations are really kind of causing, I would say, the perfect storm as to why we're seeing this different type of hesitancy.
Because of your expertise, you're a trusted source. So I'm imagining there's probably people in your life, whether professionally or outside of work, that maybe come to you with questions about this vaccine, concerns about it. I mean, what have you been hearing sort of anecdotally?
I have been getting a lot of questions and I've been trying to answer them the best that I could. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, the fact that first of all, would you get it? That seems to be the first question that I'm getting. Like, well, do you feel comfortable? And, you know, and I kind of talk about the data and that this hasn't been tested in a small population. I mean, we're talking thousands of people have gone through the trial process. So there's that. I think the other question that I have been asked is essentially, I think the question that you asked earlier, how long is, what's the duration of immunity? So how long will this confer protection? Which is, again, we don't know yet. A lot of it will depend on once this starts rolling out and what it looks like, what the pandemic looks like in the United States. I think the other question that we're getting also a lot is, are you concerned about sort of the safety and the side effects? So in the Pfizer product, there were some clinical trial participants that talked about a couple of them felt unwell for a couple of days. We've heard that before, particularly with regards to the flu vaccine, where people will get the influenza vaccine and then they will say, you know what, I don't feel really good for a couple of days. And sometimes people think that that means that they got the flu. I'm just trying to explain that, you know, in any of the vaccines that will be available here in the United States, there's absolutely no way that you would get the virus from the vaccine. So if you do feel unwell, that it is normal, but to continue to talk to your doctor, right, or whoever you got the vaccine from, whether that's a pharmacist, whoever, so that you feel comfortable with what the side effects are and don't have cause for concern. Really important for you to have a trusted source to talk to and ask questions.
In a moment, we will have a story about U.S. Senator Mike Enzi wrapping up his time in Washington, and we'll hear how one community is handling the holiday shopping season during the pandemic. This is Open Spaces.
This time on the Modern West, the rise of food insecurity in shrinking towns.
We've had some very devastating hailstorms that destroyed the gardens that a lot of people depend on to eat off of through the fall and the winter.
The Garden on the Prairie, part 7 of our Ghost Towning series. Find the Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. With COVID-19's effects on businesses throughout the state, there have been concerns how all of Wyoming's small businesses are faring, especially during this holiday season. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with Sheridan County Chamber of Commerce CEO Dixie Johnson about how Sheridan businesses have adapted this year. Johnson begins by describing how a local holiday tradition was affected.
In our community, there has been a really big effort to encourage people to support and continue to support local businesses, especially with the challenging times that we find ourselves in. This year was the 25th anniversary of our Christmas Stroll, which is typically it's an event that the Chamber coordinates, and it's held the Friday after Thanksgiving every year. And usually it involves shutting streets down. People come out. It's very festive. We have organizations, the groups giving away hot chocolate, different things on the streets and musicians and all of that. This year was a little different. A lot different. When we started early on kind of planning, we knew that we were going to have to kind of wait and see what happened with it based on where we were with COVID. And we were down about 10% in the number of businesses that participated, but we felt that that was really, really not bad at all under the circumstances. And so we held a non-event event the day after Thanksgiving from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. And really the idea was to encourage people, motivate people, incentivize people to get out and shop and dine and support local businesses. And that was very, very successful this year.
And so how have businesses been doing overall?
They're doing okay. It kind of depends on the business. It kind of depends on maybe some of the adaptations that they have made. But we've had several of our businesses, retail businesses especially, have started to offer their products online over recent months. Back in the spring when COVID almost shut down everything, right, and did shut down several of our different businesses and different industries, we started pulling together small groups, little think tanks. And we had a couple of retail groups that we were meeting with on a weekly basis, and they really started helping each other out. A lot of the businesses who already had like an online presence were helping other businesses develop an online presence, and some of that was really neat to see.
What are some examples of how businesses have adapted?
We have a restaurant here in our community that has, in the summertime, has opened up an outdoor patio, a deck, and everybody loves sitting on the deck. And with the restrictions and having to take, feeding out of their restaurant earlier on and the fall weather on its way, that restaurant ended up kind of enclosing that outdoor decking area to expand their seating. So they kind of, they adjusted to be able to still keep their doors open. So that was really cool to see. Like I said, several of our businesses have had like shoppers that they've FaceTimed with. And so the shoppers can be on FaceTime or some other kind of virtual, platform. And somebody in the store can go around and then the person on the other end can shop that way. We have one business that sets up appointments and people can sign up for those FaceTime shopping experiences.
Yeah, and as the holiday shopping season comes to a close, is there anything that you're preparing for? I know that the town's big winter rodeo has been canceled. And in the past couple of years, that's been a really big boost to businesses during Sheridan's historically slower season.
Yeah, that's a disappointment, but it's also understandable because we want to make sure that we can keep our businesses open. And so, and it's hard because it's that balancing act. We want to support our local businesses and we want them to be strong and vibrant, healthy. But we also don't want to have a large event where you're going to see an increased spread in COVID by bringing people together, irresponsibly. So it's understandable. I think looking forward to the future, trying to remain optimistic is one of the things that we're doing and a lot of our businesses are really doing. And they're really hopeful. We've got a couple more weeks. Well, what? Not even 2 weeks yet before Christmas. We're just hopeful that the last couple of weeks, we see really strong support of our local businesses. Again, it's retail, but it's restaurants, it's our bars, our hospitality, industry, it's everybody and our service industry. It's just if we can continue to support those local businesses and help give them a little bit of a boost or a little bit of a little bit of help to survive through the winter, that's going to be really, really important.
Dixie Johnson is the CEO of the Sheridan County Chamber of Commerce. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks, Catherine.
Let's go to Washington. After more than two decades of representing Wyoming in the United States Senate, Mike Enzi is retiring. Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo talked with some of his colleagues about what his departure means, and they all agree it's going to leave a huge deficit in the upper chamber.
Mike Enzi first came to Washington in the 60s to get his bachelor's degree in accounting from George Washington University. After heading home, he served in the Wyoming Air National Guard, was mayor of Gillette, then spent time as a Wyoming state representative and a state senator. He came full circle in 1997 when he came back to Washington as U.S. Senator Mike Enzi. But he's glad that time has come to an end.
I'm ready to be in Wyoming and excited about it.
Since November's elections, as party leaders have been scrambling to fund the government and pass another round of coronavirus stimulus for the ailing economy, Enzi sold his home here and has been packing decades of memories up from his office. So when I asked about what he was thinking on his way to cast one of his final votes at the Capitol, Enzi wasn't thinking about his legacy.
Too busy to have much go through my head.
But some of the Senate colleagues Enzi's leaving behind have been discussing his legacy, and they agree that his retirement is going to leave a huge hole in the Capitol. Indiana Republican Senator Mike Braun is a first-term senator. One of his main committees is the Budget Committee that Enzi chaired. Braun laments that Enzi was given a gavel by GOP leaders, but never the power to rein in federal spending like Enzi always wanted.
Well, it's going to be a big loss because it should be the most important committee in the U.S. Senate. And sadly, budgeting has been thrown aside. That's why we've got structural trillion-dollar deficits. And Mike has been a calm, reasoned voice, citing it. And a lack of political will in this place in general, that's why we do nothing about it. So,
some could say Enzi was a broken record when it came to federal spending. Even as both parties sought to rack up deficit spending over the years, Enzi was most always a thorn in leaders' sides.
Not just loud, consistent voice.
That's Oklahoma Republican Senator James Lankford.
And that's what's been there, is that he's always bringing up the issue of debt, deficit, dealing with budget points of order. What does this really mean long term? He'll be missed because he has real skill and wisdom in that area.
Lankford never served under Enzi, but he says he made a mark on him and others.
That when people bring something up, he has the ability to be able to look at it and say, this is what that really means. And so some people will say, yeah, that sounds fine. And he'll say, hey, are you aware that shifts things to mandatory spending and it means this long term and it takes it off budget and this is the real effect of the deficit. So yeah, he'll really be missed in that area.
Enzi's known as an old school lawmaker who most always sought to forge compromises across the aisle. So his departure is bittersweet to more moderate, deficit-focused Democrats like Delaware Senator Tom Carper.
Actually, during the time he's been budget chair, we've had the largest budget deficits in the history of the country. So, despite his leadership.
Carper says even though Enzi warned his party leaders against using the nation's credit cards, the nation's debt was still able to hit its record $27 trillion under his tenure.
We have gone the wrong way. Unfortunately, the president's not much of a fiscal conservative. So regardless of how good the budget chair was, the leadership at the top wasn't with him.
Enzi's being replaced in the Senate by former Wyoming Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis, who is also known as a fiscal hawk. And even though Oklahoma Senator Lankford served with her in the House and respects her, he says,
oh yeah, that'd be helpful, but there aren't two Mike Enzis. I mean, he's an accountant. He understands the issues well. He's been chairman of the Budget Committee, so he knows all the ins and outs. So anybody walking in will be playing catch-up ball. I've worked on the budget issues for 10 years now, but I'm still playing catch-up ball to what he already knows.
As Enzi's been packing his bags, belongings, and towers of boxes of late, he says the issue he devoted his Senate career to, the nation's fiscal health, has been far from his mind.
I've always worried about that. It's not my job now.
As for leaving Washington, Enzi's ready to be home in Wyoming.
Miss the people, not the place, not the schedule for sure.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
In the next segment, we will hear about the significance of the Festival of Lights, and we will hear from Wyoming's Poet Laureate. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, Moyambi was excited to take his friends on a cycling trip across his home country of Uganda. But one night for dinner, they had to get creative.
I had my friend cut off the head. He kept saying he had never done it before.
A vegan's guide to eating chicken. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. When a grizzly bear enters more human-populated areas or gets into human-bear conflicts, wildlife managers try different ways to stop the bear from their bad habits. But if it continues, one management technique is killing the bear. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska explains how researchers try to not let that death go to waste and help educate the public.
Early one morning, 8 volunteers surround a table the size of a picnic table. On the table is a 400-pound grizzly bear carcass. Draper Natural History Museum assistant curator Corey Anko says they are defleshing the animal.
So they are removing all of the meat around the bones, all the meat around the ribs, all the meat around the vertebrae. And they're trying to get this as clean as we can, reasonably so.
Anko says once the bones are cleaned as well as possible without hurting them, the bones are then given to flesh-eating beetles.
They will then clean those bones to the best of their ability, and they do a remarkable job with minimal or no damage at all to the skeletons, as opposed to boiling it, which can really kind of break down the integrity of the skeleton.
And only then will the bones be put back together to be a bear skeleton, which will be put on display in the Natural History Museum. Nathan Dorr is the Draper Natural History Museum curator.
Our collection focuses especially on wildlife, and we rely for that collection on salvaged and transferred specimens.
That means they get specimens from game and fish like this one or roadkill.
So when we rely on those salvages and those transfers, you know, we do have voids in our collection because we're limited to what we're able to bring in.
Dorr says many natural history museums over the years have relied heavily on researchers or explorers traveling and coming back with specimens. But the Draper prefers this approach.
Unfortunately, those specimens aren't, they certainly aren't prime specimens. You know, when we talk about putting them on exhibit or even, you know, skeletal remains, that can really kind of affect the quality of the collection.
But they have figured a way around this problem. And that's through a partnership with Game and Fish. BearWise coordinator Dusty Lassiter explains how they got this 400-pound grizzly.
We caught him this spring after he was killing chickens, and he had lost about 80 pounds. He had a big wound in his back, probably from being bit by another bear, and he was just in really poor physical shape, and he was desperate.
Lassiter says this wasn't the first time they had found the bear. He kept on causing problems, so that plus his bad physical shape meant it was time to take the bear's life. At this point, management decides what to do with the carcass, throw in the landfill, or donate.
This was a perfect specimen for the museum because it was a mature adult male. He had a pretty good coat. He was in, you know, had long hair and was a good specimen.
Through this partnership, the museum hopes to get more specimens in the future, and it sounds like Game and Fish thinks that's a good idea. Lassiter says the department tries to donate good specimens to educational institutions so that the specimens can help educate the public about their bone structure, size, and physical features.
For us, it buys more public tolerance and just in general increases people's awareness and education on the landscape.
Once the grizzly's bones are ready, they will put him on display. Their hope is to continue this partnership so as to expand their collection and educate the public on a wide range of species. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Thank you.
Now to the arts. Wyoming's poet laureate Eugene Galeano recently published a poem he called The Blessing of Wyoming in the New York Times. The publication had an open call for poet laureates across the country to write about what they're thankful for about their state during this pandemic. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao chats with Galeano on the story behind the poem, but first a reading of his poem, The Blessing of Wyoming.
The Blessing of Wyoming. Wyoming residents are grateful having been spared much of the suffering. We enjoyed fresh air outdoors, free to roam vast grasslands, massive mountains carved by nature, furrowed deep canyons, and valleys sewn together by icy streams. We watched herds of mountain, rainy elk, and prairie pronghorn. Each new day was a gift. Even the drought and winds couldn't dry out our spirit. Board games, puzzles, and books became important again. We looked after each other, neighbor helping neighbor, despite long distances. We nourished our faith and appreciated more family time. We reached out to old friends, became even more aware of the people and the natural blessings of Wyoming.
All right, so I want to know what really made you write the poem. How did you come up with it?
Well, first of all, one of the things I do often is I walk each day, or at least 5 days a week, and I go down to Clear Creek, which is at the base of the Bighorn Mountains, and it's beautiful, and I'm so grateful to have it. And I just started putting my thoughts together. I said, well, what am I really thankful for, and what are the people around me thankful for? And the ones I have talked to, whether they were ill or not, just agreed that, you know, we are fortunate that we hadn't been touched by the virus as much as some people across the country, and that we were not confined to apartments. The majority of us are not confined to an apartment or in the city where we can't get out. I mean, we have all this space. And one of the things that since I moved here is, like, the people here are just so caring. We help each other out. That's what we've been doing. So I thought, I just started putting all of these thoughts together, and then I went home and just kind of sketched it out.
Okay, so I'm curious, when your poem got published, how did you feel?
Well, I was happy. You know, I thought, well, that's kind of neat. It's always nice to have your work recognized. And then I thought, well, good. This gets out there and people can have a different viewpoint maybe of Wyoming.
You're originally from Niagara Falls.
Mm-hmm. I was born and raised there.
What was the decision? What made you decide to move to Wyoming?
For 2 years or 2 summers when I was in college, I went on a traveling summer camp for boys. And, well, the first year we went southwest and we put 11,000 miles in the cars and camped at national parks. And we did the same thing the next year, only we went northwest. And after having seen the west, I was hooked. And so my wife and I told her, I said, you're going to love this. You got to see it. So I took her out the next summer, and she agreed. She wanted to live out here. It was beautiful. Fresh air, blue skies. And we looked around, and I started writing letters to different chambers of commerce. I wanted to be a place where there was fresh water, clean air, lots of beautiful mountains. And we started sending them out, and it just happened. It fell into place that I got a call from Buffalo, and they said, if you come out here, we'd be more than interested in having you teach, probably. And I said, oh, sure, no problem. I got off the phone, and I said, I got to come up with some money. I got to fly out to Buffalo. And I did, and I fell in love with it, and I passed my, you know, test, and next thing you know, I was out here.
Yeah, I also forgot to ask, how are you doing during this pandemic?
Oh, well, I'm doing well. I tried to I called lots of people, make sure they're doing okay, and we have helped out some other folks here that needed help. Passing it along seems to be a big thing here in Wyoming. You know, someone does something good for you, say thanks, and then pass it along to somebody else. And I've learned that ever since I moved here. And it makes you feel good, too, to make somebody else smile or, you know, just be a little more upbeat. Because if you don't, it just drags you down, and, you know, you only get one life. You got to make the best of it.
So what's next? What are you working on? What do you want to do? What's going to happen?
Well, as a poet laureate, my job, and even if it wasn't my job, I get out there and I go to lots of schools and promote reading and writing and poetry. and is getting other people excited about writing and showing them that they can do it. You know, show them that they got thoughts, worthwhile thoughts. A lot of people say they don't have anything to write about, but they do. And I just try to bring that out of them, especially kids. I love kids.
Yeah, I can see that. Thank you so much for talking to us, Mr. Eugene Galliano.
You're very welcome. Thank you for getting it out to other people.
Of course, the holiday season is upon us, and with it comes the Festival of Lights, better known as Hanukkah. Folks around the country are lighting their menorahs, including here in Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with University of Wyoming Professor of Religious Studies Seth Ward about the holiday's meaning this year.
Hanukkah is celebrated for 8 days, according to the Jewish calendar. It usually occurs in very late November and or in mid-December. The holiday celebrates the rededication of the temple in the times of the Maccabean Revolt in approximately 167 to 164 BCE, and is largely celebrated by lighting the Hanukkah lights. And in fact, as time went on, the rabbi said that the main thing that was celebrated was a miracle associated with the oil that was supposed to last for only one day, provided light for 8 days. In addition, the festival celebrates, you might say, the independence of the Jewish state back in those days. And here in America, we very often talk about this as a victory for religious freedom and religious liberty, and a revolt against oppression by the Hellenistic Greeks based in Syria by the Seleucid Empire.
So how have you seen Wyoming celebrate the holiday this year, and has it been different than past years that you've seen?
Well, you know, this year, almost everybody is doing Zoom. So normally one would expect to have a number of Hanukkah parties, most of the congregations. There are organized congregations in Laramie, in Casper, in Cheyenne, and in Jackson Hole. Most of these organizations would have had Hanukkah parties of some sort or get-togethers. There was a Hanukkah lighting in Laramie on, I think it was Sunday night, and the Chabad of Wyoming had took part in a lighting of candles at the governor's office with the governor, as they almost always do. And I think it was live.
So what messages of Hanukkah are particularly relevant in this unique year?
You know, this year is very much unique. And I think every year, the message of a famous saying, which I have seen attributed to the Baal Shem Tov, a Jewish leader and the traditional founder of the Hasidic movement. The message of the Baal Shem Tov about Hanukkah was, a little light dispels a lot of darkness. Me'at or doche harbe min ha'hoshech. And I think the idea of light dispelling darkness is good every year, but this year I think it is especially relevant. We have a little bit of light that came during Hanukkah, the beginning of inoculations against the coronavirus, against the COVID-19. And, you know, in the historic Hanukkah, there were miles and miles to go when things didn't really work out as well historically for the Maccabees as the story seems to tell. But on the whole, there was a little light, and it did dispel an awful lot of darkness at that time. I think the idea of standing up for principles and going forward is always relevant, and I think it's particularly inspirational at this time.
Anything else relevant to add in this conversation before we sign off?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things that I've seen an awful lot of people doing for Hanukkah is Zoom cooking and Zoom singing. In terms of other things this year, the COVID virus, I think, has made us aware of the importance of community. And Hanukkah typically is one of these holidays that is a family and a community affair. Many communities have parties or they have opportunities to get together. And I think that the presence of Zoom activities during this time of darkness is a beacon of light that tells us how important it is to keep up our ties with our communities.
Seth, thank you so much for joining me, and happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah to you, and thank you very much for reaching out to me, and we should all have a happy and a healthy and a sane and safe and strong year.
Coming up, we will wrap up the program by hearing from some who are having Christmas alone. This is Open Spaces.
Event that you go to annually that fascinates you, or maybe something that has happened in the past that you just want to know more about? Well, if you're between the ages of 7 and 13, you're in luck. The Kids Ask Why podcast is looking for curious kids who want to find out more. You can find out more about powwows, Yellowstone fires, or about a local event your town hosts annually. Find the application at wyomingpublicmedia.org under the podcast page.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. This year, the holidays are looking different for many people across Wyoming. With concerns about spreading COVID-19 to loved ones, some are opting to stay home this holiday season. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler brings us this postcard from some who are spending their first holiday alone.
It's like the first time that I haven't had something to do, and it's just so par for the course for this year of just things just happening, and you just kind of take it as it comes.
I usually get together with a group of friends. Most of us work together throughout our professional careers. It's our tradition to usually gather at Thanksgiving and Christmas. And this year, we all decided not to do that.
Well, we usually plan on like a giant family dinner, which, well, we call it dinner, but it's at like 1 in the afternoon, but it usually lasts for like, you know, 3 or 4 hours of everybody just kind of hanging out together.
My family's parents are in their 60s. You know, the last time I went home, I drove, and that's a 16-hour ordeal. I can't do that right now or as frequently as I'd like. And I'm not going to put them at risk just because I'm homesick or because I want to go home.
So those are the two times of the year that I would usually be able to get to see everybody, or at least the majority of everybody, just because we usually do have like one or two family members who don't live in the state come and visit. And obviously that's not going to be the case this year.
Not to say it's not a great loss to not share holidays with friends and family. My family all lives on the East Coast, and so I'm not going to fly there. They're not going to fly here. And so, it's not ideal, but it's something that I accept, and I'm not bummed out about it. I missed a lot of the annual holiday events that we have in our community, whether they're open houses at favorite shops or our tree lighting happened remotely, things like that. So, there's a lot of sacrifices that people are making, but I think that it's a small sacrifice.
When Thanksgiving came around, it was like the first time that we had that big talk of like, okay, what are we going to do? And then as things have been progressing, we decided that we would just opt out of not doing a family get-together, but instead opting for a Zoom call, which I actually slept through and totally spaced out on. But I believe that's what we're going to probably end up doing right now.
You know, I enjoy reading, so I'll do a lot of reading. I like music. I'll listen to music. You know, some of the cheesy holiday movies that come on, I may watch those.
So I made latkes, and my mom was, like, super jealous because she's like, yours are so much better than mine. I do that, you know. I light my menorah. You know, I'm not, like, a super religious person, but there's just something about having a routine in that normalcy that makes you feel like you're a little bit closer to home because you know your family's doing it too.
I'm sad to be missing the meal and the holiday get-togethers. I am doing, you know, some traditional Christmas cookie baking just because it wouldn't feel right to be in December and not, you know, have that.
Like, I sent my mom a picture of my menorah and she sent me hers. And it's the same menorah she had when I was a kid. And there's just something like so stupidly comforting about that.
When I was growing up, my mother would use a cookie press, an old-fashioned cookie press. And we would make a cookie called Holly Reeves. And I actually stocked up on the ingredients so I can do them again in the next couple of days or week or so.
New Year's is always the big one for me just because of the tradition with my sister. I think that's going to be tough because our tradition was we would go to the Rose Bowl every January 1st. It's just odd and to know that, you know, I'm not going to be able to go with my sister this year and, you know, tailgate way earlier than we should and just watch some good football and meet new people and hang out. It's it was like one of my favorite things to do.
I still find myself just incredibly exhausted just to have the day in, day out of just going to work that, like, even, like, outside of the pandemic, I was constantly busy and I never felt this worn out. And I think it's just because of, like, the mental exhaustion of the grind of days and not seeing people that, like, just doing absolutely nothing is incredibly appealing to me right now.
I've had invitations to go to a friend's house for a meal, but I honestly think I'm going to be working on Christmas. I think that's my understanding.
For some people, it is really going to be hard and sad for people to have to be alone and not to be with their families. For me, the heartache is those families this year at the holidays who have lost their loved ones because they're going through the first time in perhaps their lives they've ever been without someone close to them, someone in their household. So I feel really bad for those people.
I think this whole 8, 9, however many months it's been, I don't even know anymore, has really kind of taught me a lot about myself that I can't operate alone. You know, you always have those moments when you're like, I don't know if I can do this. I need to call mom. I need to call dad. I need to go home. And you can't do that right now.
The biggest theme of 2020 has been like reflection on what's going on in your lives. And I think that, like, you shouldn't necessarily have to wait for something like Christmas or anything like that. But I do think that it's kind of a perfect time to take that kind of emotional and stock in the things around you and like the people that you have in your lives. And even if you aren't able to like see those people, to at least make some sort of concentrated effort to like say hi and like remind yourself that these are people that in any other situation you might have taken it for granted.
It's okay to feel whatever you're feeling. It's okay to be sad that you're not with your family. It's okay to want to be around people, but this is a hurdle and this isn't permanent. What's another couple days, you know? And so it's okay to want to do those things that you've been doing forever, but the end is in sight, hopefully. And, you know, in 2021, hopefully you're not going to be alone again.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces today and throughout 2020. It's been quite a year. On behalf of our news team, we wish you happy holidays, and let's hope 2021 is a little easier to maneuver. Segments from this show are available at wyomingpublicmedia.org and on our station Facebook page. This program is also available on podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.